We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, tons to cover this morning. So starting with developments in Olympia.
Yeah, that special session had a point, didn't it?
I know.
Got our money's worth on that one.
Yeah, no, they just started their second special session in Olympia this Tuesday because Senate Republicans won't bestir themselves to vote on a compromised budget. And so Jav is going to tell you a little bit about what the Senate Republicans have been doing.
Actually, I thought you had that one.
Okay, well, I will talk about it then. The Senate Republicans have been passing all of these different policy bills instead of working seriously on the budget.
And then insisting that those policy bills be part of the budget.
Yeah,
but they won't move on the budget until they pass that stuff.
That they won't work on a budget until the House, which is majority Democrats, pass these policy bills. And I'm just going to go through them very quickly. One of them is the workers' comp bill. That's a bill to let companies give injured workers one-time smaller settlements for workers' comp claims. The second one is the education reform bill. It's education reform in quotes. It would allow principals to reject teachers who are reassigned to their schools, give them veto power over who their staff is. The budget cap bill that would cap all non-education spending at 6% of new revenue, which is crazy. And then the fourth bill would weaken regulations governing payday loans. Just a couple of years ago, the legislature passed a bill that would strengthen regulations governing payday loans so that payday lenders wouldn't be gouging people.
Although the limit on that, I believe, is still 394% annual interest rate.
Yeah, the interest rates are still high, but there are limits on the number of loans that people can take out from payday lenders, so that you can't get completely, or supposedly can't get completely in hock to them, and a limit in the amount of money you can borrow each time. And Republicans wanna do away with those limits. And then there's a bill to amend the Model Toxic Cleanup Act, which was passed by voters. That bill to amend the act would allow private companies to use public funds to clean up toxic spills, which is not what the Toxic Cleanup Fund was meant to do. It was meant to clean up public agency spills, not private companies. So those are the bills that the Republicans are demanding that the Democrats pass in the House before they will even look at a compromise bill.
Most of them having nothing to do with the budget itself.
Yeah. And the one that does have anything to do with the budget, the budget cap bill, is a horrendous piece of legislation.
All right. Anything else out of Olympia?
Nope. Let's move on.
Okay.
Only that, as we mentioned last week, the state government is already in violation of the law by not passing the budget by June 1st, because they have to have 30 days notice before the new calendar year. But if they don't pass it by July 1st, we're looking at a possible state government shutdown. And so we have Rodney Tom, the Newt Gingrich of our time.
All right. All right. Well, speaking of cuts, Pierce Transit looking at some cuts.
Yeah, the Pierce Transit Board voted on Monday to approve a 28% cut in bus service starting in September. As part of these cuts, most of Northeast Pierce County is going to be largely abandoned, especially on weekends. The small cities of Milton, Fife, and Edgewood are losing major routes that connect them to the transit hubs in Federal Way, Puyallup, and downtown Tacoma. Now, in 2011, Pierce Transit cut service by one-third. So this 28% cut, again, almost a one-third cut, comes on top of a previous one-third cut in service. Now, at that time in 2011, East Pierce County towns asked to be removed from the transit district, the towns of Bonnie Lake, Sumner, Ording, and Little Old Buckley, way over in the eastern end of Pierce County. They decided they didn't want to contribute taxes to the transit district if they weren't going to get any service out of it, and they seceded from the district. Now, this time around, Milton, Fife, and Edgewood are considering that, but those are growing communities, particularly
and
Edgewood.
They're much closer to Tacoma itself.
Yeah, and they together contributed about $4 million in taxes to the Pierce Transit District in 2011, but they only received about $2.75 million in bus services, so they're already getting shorted in terms of their tax base. So, and again, if they withdraw from the district, these growing communities that sit between King County and Pierce County and Tacoma, That could mean a fracturing of the Pierce Transit District itself, and that could be a big problem for Pierce Transit. It's going to impact their revenues. There are going to be further cuts, and it's a downward spiral from there. And I just mention this not because it's going to impact many of our listeners in King County, but because it looks like a foreshadowing of what we might be encountering here in King County with Metro bus service cuts that could be coming soon.
And in both district cases, loss of funding from the state plays a big part in this also.
Yeah, and you know, the reason for the cuts in Pierce County is because voters wouldn't approve an increase in the sales tax to fund transit. And I want to talk briefly, too, about the transportation budget in the state legislature. The Republicans released their transportation budget this past week, and the differences between their transportation budget and the Democrats really point to some of the problems that, that local transit agencies are having. Now, first of all, the revenue in the Republican Senate's transportation budget is almost the same as the Democrats. They want a 10.5 cent gas tax over 10 years versus the Democrats proposing a 10-cent increase in the gas tax over 12 years. Pretty much the same, apples to apples there. But in terms of expenses, the number one problem is that the Republican budget doesn't include any money for transit, bikes, or pedestrians. $0 in the transportation budget, whereas the Democrats want to provide $420 million for transit and $370 million for bikes and pedestrians. In addition, Republican budget would include a temporary sales tax increase of 0.3% for local transit and roads. So local transit districts could impose that 0.3% sales tax increase to fund those or put that in front of the voters. But it would expire in 2018. And we can look at Pierce Transit and how the voters voted down twice a sales tax increase for transit there. And you can see that that's a non-starter. The Democrats, on the other hand, have proposed allowing local transit districts to increase the motor vehicle excise tax by 1.5% and use 50% of that for transit and 50% of that for roads. And I think that's a much, much better proposal.
It's almost as though Republicans don't think global warming is happening.
That's right. That's right. Well, they certainly don't care if transit districts are dismantled, which is what's going on in Pierce County.
All right. Developments this week with Nicholsville?
Yeah. Mayor McGinn ordered Nicholsville, the homeless encampment in South Seattle, to be vacated by September 1st, just in time for it to start to get colder. His hand was really forced on this by a city council, McGinn saying they could no longer avoid enforcement of the ordinance against camping on industrial land after the council expressed its intent to no longer tolerate that lack of enforcement. Seven of the nine city council members sent a letter to McGinn at the beginning of the week, everybody except Nick Licata and Mike O'Brien, those seven council members demanding closure in compliance with city law, and that said that by September 1st, the city should provide, and this is a direct quote, immediate targeted outreach and engagement services to the Nicholsville residents, along with immediate provisions of shelter, housing, and other services. Of course, that letter didn't have any suggestions as to where that money was going to come from, where the plan to do it was going to come from, or how it was going to be implemented in the next 3 months.
Why they haven't done it up till now.
Or when the city hasn't done it in the last 30 years or so of mass homelessness in the area. You know, beyond the fact that some homeless people don't even want to use Seattle's shelters. They're overcrowded. They're sometimes unsafe.
The shelters force you to sex segregate. So if you have a family of a man, a woman, and a couple of children, the man has to go to his own shelter, and the woman with the children have to go to a separate one.
Yeah,
a lot of families don't want to be separated.
And you know, you have even by the one night homelessness count, which most homelessness advocates and service agencies will tell you is a strong undercount. It's a good year to year comparison, but in terms of overall numbers, it's probably low. But even by that measure, you have 2,000 to 3,000 people in King County on any given night, who are homeless. And at the same time, you've got shelter provisions for a couple 300 of them at most. So there just isn't a place for them to go. And Nicholsville is much safer than the alternative of sleeping on your own. It is, in fact, a home and a community of sorts. But what we've got going on here is the same thing that's been ruling Seattle for many, many, many years, which is lots of hand-wringing about homelessness, but the basic end policy has been for a very long time, and the preferred policy of a lot of people, that the big problem with homelessness is that it's visible. And the big problem with homelessness is that people are aware that it exists. It's bad for the city's image. This is what's driving this dynamic. And this is why Nicholsville was created in the first place, was to make the problem more visible because of the terrible homelessness policies of the Nichols administration. So it's sounding now a lot like Nicholsville needs about 8 suburbs, one for each city council member who pushed this and one for Mayor McGinn.
Bagshawville.
Something like that. Now bear in mind that the two city council members who didn't want to go along with this very bad idea, Mike O'Brien and Nick Licata, are both up for re-election this year, and for that matter, Richard Conlon and Sally Bagshaw, who supported it, are also up for re-election. I'm just saying.
Well, speaking of elections, public finance issue.
Yeah, the city council poised also to pass a public campaign finance bill, which would send it to voters in November as a charter amendment. Now, this sounds like great news. Yeah, well, it's not actually. It's terrible news and a good reminder of why you need to actually read the fine print in a bill as well as what it's about or its title. In this case, when Seattle last had public funding of local elections, which was up until the early 1980s, to be eligible for funds, candidates had to meet the eligibility criteria of having 300 or more qualified donors. Qualified meaning that they're over 18 U.S. citizens and are eligible to donate. The current legislation in a city of about the same population, Seattle is a little bit more now than it did 30 years ago, but it's relatively comparable, calls for 600 such donors. Now, if that sounds like a lot, it is. In the last decade's local elections, every incumbent has met that threshold, but almost no challengers have. So what you have, if we're going by the historical record, is this would be a bill that would give public funds to help finance the campaigns of incumbents, but not their challengers. Think about that for a minute and understand that it's the incumbents who are running in these elections who are actually trying to pass this bill and send it to voters. Certainly no challengers have met it in time for the primary, and now that you have the primary in August and you have a media landscape where there's much less coverage of local politics, and therefore people with name recognition have an even greater built-in advantage at the beginning of a campaign, it's certainly a recipe to even make incumbents stronger in the primary, which undermines the chances of a challenger in the general if there's already an election result that shows that they got the challenger got very few votes. They're going to have much harder trouble getting more donors after the primary, and that in turn makes it even harder for them to qualify for the public financing. Now, that's one pernicious effect of this. The other is that the charter amendment to require a mixed district at-large system for Seattle City Council seats, 7 districts and 2 at-large, submitted roughly double the number of signatures that it needed to get on the ballot this week. So that's likely going to be on the November election, on the November ballot also. And public financing of elections is one of the main arguments that's used against the district system, saying, well, if the problem is that that people can't afford to run for public office because it's too expensive, public financing is a better solution to that, a more direct solution than simply carving the city into districts where people can as an alternative of raising money, go door to door and have a greater local community presence. So this would be the worst of both worlds because it would be used to undermine the district initiative. And at the same time, it doesn't actually make it more affordable for challengers. Quite the opposite. It makes a more difficult task for challengers because it's only giving the public assistance the way the law is currently written to incumbents. So it's a lose-lose in this situation.
All right. Also, developments this week in terms of guns.
Yeah, a new statewide initiative was filed this week. The Washington Alliance for Gun Responsibility filed an initiative to close the gun show loophole. It would require criminal background checks for all gun sales, including private sales and ones online and ones at gun shows, et cetera. And I suppose it would also close that little loophole that allows people to buy guns outside of a gun buyback program. Washington State Legislature considered a couple of bills this year that would do the same thing, but they failed to pass anything this year. So given that 79% of Washington registered voters support closing the private gun sale loophole, according to a recent Elway poll, I think this is a very, very good development. Now, if they get enough signatures, the legislature could take up this initiative and decide to pass it into law. Or if they pass on doing anything about it, then it would go to the ballot next year. That's for the November 2014 election.
All right. On to national and developments with Plan B.
Yeah, the Obama administration announced this week that they would pursuing an appeal against Judge Edward Corman's order to make the Plan B contraceptives available over the counter to women and girls of all ages without a prescription. And I thought that was very, very good news. Now, the FDA, after more than a decade-long review, had finally approved it for sale to women and girls of all ages, but Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius then stepped in and blocked that decision, saying that her decision was based on science. But the FDA decision had originally looked at all of the scientific evidence and concluded that Plan B could be taken by women and girls of all ages, and Sebelius really had done it for political reasons. In fact, federal Judge Corman overruled Sebelius, saying that her decision was, quote, politically motivated, scientifically unjustified, and contrary to agency precedent. And he said, quote, the FDA has engaged in intolerable delays in processing the petition. Indeed, it could accurately be described as an administrative agency filibuster.
That whole decision, by the way, was just scathing.
Yeah, it was completely scathing. And so this is good news, I think, that the DOJ has finally realized that by appealing this, we're not going to get anywhere, and it's time to finally, after more than a decade, make this available.
All right. Tangential to that, the Republicans this week showing.
Apologizing for rape.
it's amazing how the abortion debate plays into. What is it about Republican white guys and rape? I don't get it. The question of that rhetorical question continues. In the state of Wisconsin this week, their legislature becomes the latest, and Republican hero Governor Scott Walker has said he will sign legislation to force vaginal ultrasounds on women who want abortions. So we now have another state in the process of state mandated rape. The same legislature also passed a couple of other lovely bills. One of them bans state health care plans from covering abortions and exempts religious groups from the state requirement to provide birth control insurance coverage. The other prohibits sex-selective abortions and imposes fines on physicians. The ultrasound bill also requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges in a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic. That's a tactic that's been used in other states to try and drive both clinics and then their doctors out of business. And Planned Parenthood has already said that would force their clinics to shut down in a couple of the smaller cities in Wisconsin where they are now. Meanwhile, in other rape culture news, Representative Trent Franks, Republican from the caves of Arizona, has introduced a U.S. House of Representatives bill backed by the Republican leadership that would ban all abortion after 20 weeks, which is to say about 4.5 months, with no exceptions for rape or incest. A lot of abortions don't happen that quickly. In some cases, women don't even know they're pregnant until shortly before that timeline. But what was really representative of and interesting about this was Frank's justification for this in testimony in the House, where he said the incidence of rape resulting in pregnancy are very low. We know. And when you make the exception, that exception allowing rape victims to get abortion, there's usually a requirement to report the rape within 48 hours. And in this case, that's impossible because this is a 6-month of gestation, and that's what completely negates and vitiates the purpose of such amendment. Well, there is no requirement to report a rape within 48 hours.
No.
And many women don't for any number of very good reasons. these guys are so clueless and they are so insistent that they are not clueless that, you know, their repeated denials that there's an ongoing war against women within the Republican Party aren't very convincing. It's just, you know, the what is it about Republicans and rape boils down to one word, which is misogyny. Mm-hmm. So Frank's bill likely to pass the House, even though, as with most of the wingnut-friendly bills, the House is spending its time passing instead of, I don't know, helping to govern. It has no chance in the Senate to help Obama. But, again, this is what the House is doing.
All right. On to a Supreme Court dealing with human genes this week.
Yeah, a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court, which is very rare these days, a decision that human genes cannot be patented. This was in the case Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. It was essentially doctors suing over Myriad Genetics patents on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 breast cancer genes. Myriad has in the past sued other companies to stop them from marketing and selling tests to look for the BRCA genes, which put women at a much, much higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And they've done this, Myriad has done this for 20 years. They've literally had a monopoly. And as a result, the test that Myriad offers to look for the BRCA genes costs between $3,000 and $4,000, what many doctors say is far too expensive for their patients to afford it, particularly if the patients don't have a history of breast or ovarian cancer in their families, or perhaps they've been adopted and don't know what their family medical histories are, and in which case insurance companies won't pay for the test. You have to pay for it out of pocket.
Now, our wonderful U.S. healthcare system.
Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled that in discovering and isolating the genes, Myriad didn't create anything that could actually be patented, which is very, very good news for patients. Not so good news for companies that want to develop and patent tests to look for human genes.
And in this case, not only is a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court rare, but a decision of any kind that goes against corporate interests is also very rare from the Supreme
right.
Court.
Now
because
that,
even the Democratic appointees are very pro-corporate. So this is a really remarkable decision.
A very remarkable decision. They did, however, rule that synthetic DNA could still be patented. So that's no threat to, for example, genetically modified foods or gene-based pharmaceuticals, which are often called biologicals. So those will still be developed in the case of GM foods, unfortunately.
All right. ACLU filing a suit this week?
Yeah, the ACLU announced that they were filing suit against the Obama administration over the FBI's indiscriminate collection of domestic phone call data. They're asking that the court stop the program and order that the phone records be purged from government and contractor databases. The ACLU apparently has standing in this case since they are a customer of Verizon Business Network, which is the leaked document that was publicized last week. Now, they're arguing that there's nothing to stop the government from using the normal routes to get this information if they need to in a real anti-terrorism investigation. The government could always use subpoenas to get the information that they need rather than doing this global collecting everyone's phone call data. But the surveillance really goes much deeper than just collecting phone data. Now, according to the Guardian interview with Edward Snowden, the guy who leaked all this information in the first place, he said, quote, "We can plant bugs in machines. Once you go on the network, I can identify your machine. You will never be safe, whatever protections you put into place," end quote. And of the companies that were mentioned in the PRISM program, included in that list were Intel and Microsoft. And you have to, I mean, you can say, okay, Microsoft, sure, because of MSN, it's a media part of their company. But no, it's not MSN. It's when he says we can put bugs in your machine, he's not talking about MSN. He's talking about the Windows operating system, which is the dominant operating system in the world today. And when you mention Intel, Intel's not a software maker. Intel's not a media company. Intel is a chip maker. So when he says there are bugs in people's machines, he's talking about Intel,
hardware,
right?
Hardware
he's
and
talking
software.
About hardware yep. and software.
Yep. All right.
So I just want people to keep that in mind.
All right. The NDAA.
Yeah. The House passed its version of the National Defense Authorization Act for 2013, this Thursday. And, it was very controversial in 2012, as you'll recall, because in 2012, one of the provisions of the NDAA was to, install a policy to authorize indefinite detention on U.S. territory under the aspects of the authorization for use of military force. An amendment was offered to overturn that policy this week and rejected by the House 206 to 226, which is actually a fairly close vote. There were a number of other interesting amendments, which I'll run through very quickly because we're short on time. The good news is that for the first time, the House voted to support accelerated withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Senate did this last year, so both houses of Congress are now on record for that. And it was a large margin, 305 to 121. But there was no vote allowed on either amendment that would sunset the authorization for use of military force for Afghanistan. The rest, the House Republicans ignored sequestration and passed a bill more than $50 billion over the sequestration cap. Only 71 representatives supported an amendment to reduce the military budget by 9.4%. Only 110 supported an amendment to remove 5,000 of the hundreds of thousands of troops from Europe, which is a very expensive and unnecessary part of the military. The House Armed Services Committee had added $5 billion to Afghan funding. An amendment to strip that failed. The House approved language that nothing in the NDAA could be construed as authorizing or supporting a U.S. attack on Iran, which is good, but like the Senate before them, they also passed language encouraging an Israeli attack on Iran. And they passed an amendment banning a drone attack on U.S. citizens unless they're engaged in combat against the U.S., which is a stricter standard, apparently, than the Obama administration has been using. But at least mortar fire is still okay, I guess. And then they rejected an amendment to close Guantanamo, but approved one that banned funding for transferring detainees to Yemen, where a lot of them need to go home. So mostly not good news, but better than it has been in past years.
All right. And finally, a GMO study out this week.
Yeah, very important study. It's the first complete toxicology study on genetically modified foods, this time in pigs, not in rats or birds, some animal that's not very closely related to humans. Pigs, on the other hand, have digestive tracts that are very, very similar to the human bodies. Now, this study was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Organic Systems, and what it found was that there weren't any changes in the weight or growth of pigs or in their blood chemistry. But what it found by feeding half of the pigs in the study genetically modified corn and soy, very, very similar to what they eat in normal feedlots, that's what a toxicology study is, to mimic real-world conditions instead of just feeding them, oh, we're going to feed them some weird substrate with one genetically modified gene in it. They fed them genetically modified corn and soy that had multiple genes inserted into them. What they found in this study is two findings, that the female pigs that were fed genetically modified food had uteruses that weighed 25% more than the control group and contained more fluid. And they said that further studies should definitely be done on the hormone mimicking capability of these genetically modified genes. And what they also found, which was even more disturbing, was that in the pigs fed genetically modified food, there was a much higher rate of severe stomach inflammation, particularly of the stomach lining. They found that in the female pigs, it was more than double. And in the male pigs, the rate of severe inflammation was four times the control group. And that's pretty alarming. And given that these pigs were only fed the foods for 22 weeks rather than years and years and years, like humans have been fed these foods, I think that definitely this points out that there are some big studies that need to be done in the future on these genetically modified foods.
And they should have been done before they were ever allowed on the market in the first place.
Yeah, back in the mid-1990s.
Unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time. We don't have any time to touch on international this week. But luckily, there's a way people will be able to find that out. Events.
Just wanted to talk about, which is Monday evening, the 17th, the International Justice Day for Cleaners rally sponsored by SIU Local 6. That'll be at 3 o'clock at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine in downtown Seattle.
Talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And we haven't been able to get our notes up the last couple of weeks, but we'll definitely get them up this week so we can talk about Syria and Iran and Turkey and other stuff that we didn't have time for in the year.